Welcome to the Talking Transformation podcast. I'm your podcast host, Peter Ahmad, recording from Cape Town, South Africa, since June 2019. The Talking Transformation podcast provides an open and accessible platform for built environment professionals and interest groups to share their reflections and aspirations relating to the transformation of places and spaces in South Africa. It's intended to be a celebration of the individuals and community groups who are supporting formal and informal processes that are addressing the challenges of South Africa's history and shaping the future of our neighbourhoods and cities. Happy New Year to all Talking Transformation podcast listeners for 2024. It's an important year that will no doubt reflect on 30 years of democracy here in South Africa and consider the achievements of the democratic era and the perennial and future challenges facing communities across the country. One of those perennial challenges remains the progressive realization of housing for all, a quest that has shaped so much of the debate and policy making since 1994. It's been a central theme for many of our podcast episodes since we started out in June 2019, so it's perhaps fitting that it's a theme that kicks us off in 2024, as we consider a newly released book edited by three esteemed academics and good friends of the Talking Transformation podcast, Dr. Margot Rubin, Dr. Sarah Charlton, and Dr. Neil Klug. The book, Housing in African Cities, A Lens on Urban Governance, covers six countries and eight different cities across the continent and shapes a series of housing themes and agendas from across those cities. We try to understand the contributors and contributions that were made, what were those themes and how were these deemed important to the contributors. The three colleagues, Sarah, Neil, and Margot, have been ever present throughout my career here in South Africa. I was really interested in speaking to the three of them to understand how the themes could potentially shape or support some of the thinking going into a new human settlement white paper that's currently being developed by the National Department of Human Settlements here in South Africa. How do the themes echo some of the thinking that's going on into that white paper? How could they shape some of the policy or the legislation that follows? Our conversation took place on Monday, the 18th of January, the weekend after the country had come to a slowdown with the schools construction break. It also followed a week on from the consultation on that white paper. And given that Neil, Sarah and I were in that conversation, it seemed like a really good opportunity to reflect on the propositions of that human settlement white paper. I'm looking forward to another year of content with the Talking Transformation podcast and hoping to grow it. Its numbers beyond the 20,000 listens that we've been able to grow from our first 4 years of the podcast. It's been an incredibly rewarding and stimulating platform for me personally. I hope it continues to serve a purpose and have value in various advocacy, academic and professional spaces here in South Africa. An early reminder for any listeners that reviewing an episode of any of the Talking Transformation podcast episodes qualifies for 3 CPD points, that's Continuous Professional Development points, if you're a SACPLAN member, and for guests appearing on the episode, that qualifies you for 5 CPD points. It's going to be an interesting year, a chance to reflect on 3 decades of democracy here in South Africa, at the same time deep diving into some of the important issues and themes that continue to shape our cities and spaces. Happy New Year to all our Talking Transformation podcast listeners. And as always, we hope you enjoy the episode. So it's just coming up to 3:30 on Monday, the 18th of December, the week prior to the Christmas festive season here in South Africa. Absolutely delighted to be joined by 3 colleagues, esteemed academics. I have Dr. Margot Rubin, who actually joins us from Wales, Neil Klug in Betty's Bay, and Sarah Charlton up in Johannesburg. How are each of you today? Margot, tell us, how is Cardiff treating you? How's things going that side?
It's very well. Thanks, Pete. Nice to chat to you. It's freezing cold, grey skies, dreary, but lovely to see the warm and happy faces from South Africa.
It's lovely to hear your voice, Margot. I think this is the third time you've been on the podcast, one of the very few who've got 3 performances in this space. So great to have you with us today. Neil, closer to home here in Betty's Bay, welcome to Western Cape. I know you travelled down earlier in the week. How's things going your side?
Good. Nice to be with you. Lovely to be down at the ocean again. Really miss it up in Joburg.
Well, it's fantastic to have you here, Neil. I think one of the voices that we've been missing in my collector's pack on the podcast. So great to have you with us, Neil. Really appreciate Thanks. Your time this afternoon. And up in Johannesburg, Sarah, how are you keeping? You're saying that the weather there has been somewhat problematic, but it's great to have you with us. How's things going your side?
Hello, colleagues. Yes, it has been a lovely hot and sunny afternoon in Joburg, but the afternoon thunderclouds have built up. It's crashing and bashing around me. Very dramatic, but lovely to have a break from the heat. Hello, everybody.
Welcome, Sarah, and thanks for bearing with it. I know you had a few Wi-Fi issues earlier, and we're looking forward to having you discuss your recently published book that's come out, The Housing in African Cities, A Lens on Urban Governance. And so much of the conversation right now in South Africa is about urban governance. The three of you have edited contributions from across the continent that's looking at this issue of governance in the housing space. Tell us a bit about the genesis of the book and how did you go about unpacking and collaborating with different people from across that continent.
It began, I think, some years before. I remember meeting at Margot's place, the three of us, coming up with an idea to produce a book because we'd all been so involved in housing over many years. At that point, we were thinking of a self-written manuscript, but we were still deciding on a topic. And I think it went quiet for a year or two. I can be corrected on this. And I think I may have been Margot who came up with the idea of what about an edited book. We then resolved around what was the theme going to be. There was a whole range of possibilities. And then I think we all came to a conclusion that we had all been involved in elements of governance and that link between governance and housing. We prepared a call and we put out a call. We actually got must have been something like 26 or 27 responses in terms of abstracts. And then we had to go through a selection process of what was most relevant to the topic. We applied a workshopping process. I think it was two sets of workshops. Once people had put in their first draft and then a second draft was workshopped so that all the authors got a sense of what the other authors were writing in their chapters. So that was broadly the process. I'm sure my colleagues can add to that.
We try to put the call out as broadly as possible. So, you know, we sent it out on Facebook, we sent it out on a whole lot of different channels. And it was really interesting, the responses we got were quite a wide range, as Neil said. And then one of the things that we were desperately trying to do was to balance South Africa with the rest of the continent, because we didn't want South Africa to dominate the book. I mean, we knew it could be a big focus, but we wanted to make sure that we had a wide variety of authors and wide variety of geographical locations. And to see as, you know, if we could represent as much as possible the kind of Anglophone Africa as we could. Unfortunately, along the way, I mean, we had some great contributions from KZN that fell away. We had a great contribution from, I want to say Sudan, that fell away, unfortunately. So, you know, we had these great things, but due to circumstances, some people ran out of time or ran out of energy or ran out of, you know, whatever the case may be. We didn't get quite the diversity of location that I think we wanted.
We did get some really interesting contributions that we were really keen on trying to include in the book. But unfortunately, and perhaps as people will remember, that was very much the thick of the COVID period. People started to kind of have to deal with just so much else that was going on in their lives, going on in their workspaces, trying to adapt to the COVID situation, move online. In some ways, that kind of online process really, really worked well for us and enabled some interesting collaborations across time and space that we might not have been able to do physically. But it did mean that some of our very exciting initial contributions had to withdraw because there was just too much going on, too much on everyone's plate, as I'm sure we'll all remember at that time. So in the end, the process got whittled down a bit to those groupings of authors who were kind of able to pursue the projects that they'd identified. And I think there were quite a few people who were really interested in being part of this process early on, but who just weren't able to participate in the end. And as a result, we had perhaps a smaller grouping of African countries represented than we might have hoped right at the beginning. But I think we're still very excited at the diversity and the range of contributions that kind of stuck through what was quite a long process over 3 years.
Ultimately, you were able to gather inputs from 6 countries, 8 different cities. What were some of the themes that people wanted to respond to?
It was really interesting because there was so much that was covered. One of the things that came up quite a lot were looking at the private sector and the role that the private sector is playing in terms of housing provision and the differing relationships that the private sector has with the state. And our colleagues in in Windhoek, we're able to talk about these kind of big housing estates and how this relationship with local government was evolving in terms of how the state was accessing land and what this was meaning for the expansion of the city of Windhoek. The kind of work by Charlotte Niederhoff in Kigali in Rwanda, talking about how the state was intersecting with the private sector to create housing that was really unaffordable and not particularly useful to different people. And so, and then, of course, Sean Butcher's kind of case in South Africa, looking at these long-standing, very intricate relationships, very complex relationships between the state and the private sector. And so what we were able to, I think, get out of this you know, that particular theme was really to try and take a deep dive into understanding the complexity of the nature of the relationship between the state and large-scale private sector actors, formal private sector actors, and how that was working. So for me, that was really interesting. And then perhaps one of the other themes that came up quite interestingly was in Ibrahim's chapter on cooperatives, which was really about this question of temporality and time and thinking about what happens in terms of governance and the changing nature of relationships over long periods of time. And Sean spoke to this as well in her chapter, so did Priscilla and Albert and colleagues. You know, thinking about what happens in cities when things shift and when things change and who the actors come in and how they maneuver and how they have to change their repertoires of action, Jonty and Robin's chapter. This question of evolution and change and time and changing circumstances also became a very clear theme in the book as well.
The three of you contributed two chapters, the introductory chapter that introduces this word that's a common theme throughout the book around messy cities. And then the second thing around walk-up housing in Johannesburg. What was it about the latter, the idea of this walk-up housing in Joburg, that really focused your attention, the three of you, and that collaboration?
It stems from our common interest in informal settlement upgrading and the fact that the current model is to, you know, relocate, perceived as upgrading of informal settlements, to relocate people into these types of new topologies. Sarah actually had a contact who lived within one of these new settlements. So we had a nice sort of introduction in terms of being able to interview residents as well. So we thought we'd probe the residents, the users, and state stakeholders, like the provincial government, local Joburg City Council, in terms of how, and the developer as well. And so we ran a range of interviews across these different fields. And yeah, to establish really, fairly shockingly, that there was this huge gap in management. When you basically have a multi-story structure with units, you need a very clear structure. Particularly, and I think what stands out with this particular typology is that these are seen as RDP units on top of each other. And so many, many cases, the residents actually have no disposable income and therefore no additional money to maintain and put into a levy and put into some kind of maintenance structure. And this was a huge gap. And, you know, we probed province, the policy units, the city housing officials, like, how did this gap come about? And that was so interesting. And of course, from the residents' perspective, there was clear decline in the state of the units and a lot of frustration and conflict emerging from this lack of ongoing maintenance. A major issue too, which came upon, was the perceptions, is that people living in these new units perceived them as RDP units and therefore had family and colleagues who were living in single houses RDPs who weren't expected to pay any form of monthly contribution and thought, well, why are we required to pay a monthly contribution when we get the same product, but they don't have to pay?
It's echoing a whole lot of challenges, which we outline in the chapter about how multi-story units have not been well managed over long periods of time, including public housing stock and the big sale, and how public, you know, those multi-story public properties have been transferred to sitting tenants, and they have huge management issues and maintenance issues. So it resonated with that. But I think if we were to kind of think about it in terms of governance, what we were also interested in was, who has a say in these things? Who has voice? Who has an ability to engage? And so, you know, we're sitting in a situation where these units are provided, they're kind of handed over, and then tenants are you know, beneficiaries are pretty much left in these situations. They have no real contact with the state. The state kind of feels divested of responsibility in the sense that they've now provided the units and moved off. They've done their duty. The private sector has kind of gone, we've done our duty. We've built the units. Now we've handed them over. And so what we were pointing to was, on the one hand, the fact that there's this kind of long history of really poor management of multi-story units, and the state should have known that. They shouldn't. And on the other hand, this kind of abdication of responsibility, or these are my words, I'm not sure my colleagues would agree with me, abdication of responsibility from the state in terms of this provision of housing. And what does that say? Is this a state who doesn't care, who isn't interested, who wants to, is this a compliance-led? For us, we're trying to think about, what does this case study show us? What does it contribute to us understanding in terms of urban governance?
I think part of our concern is that thousands of these walk-ups are being rolled out. It seems to be the new model for the mixed income human settlements that are happening across Gauteng and I think several other parts of the country. And so it's happening at scale. So we're not just talking about a few isolated instances. We're talking about thousands and thousands of units where, in effect, the apartment, the flat, is a giveaway unit to a very poor person, as has been mentioned, but without the corresponding body corporate management structure, maintenance structure. And that was a key part of what we were seeing in the particular case study that we looked at in Gauteng. And we were hearing over and over again from our resident respondents the kinds of issues that they were having to confront in an unmanaged high-density development. And I use that word high-density a little bit loosely because part of the justification we were being given by provincial authorities, city authorities, the private sector developer involved, was that this was a response to the criticism about low-density, sprawling, old-style RDP settlements, that in order to counter that low-density argument, one had to use land more efficiently, and therefore walk-ups was the way to go. But people were kind of repeating this argument without really being able to show the evidence that this particular built form of three- or four-story walk-ups was in fact the best use of land. Nobody could say whether investigation had been done around row housing, duplexes, or other kinds of ground-related units, whether those would have achieved the similar forms of density. And so the density argument was being put forward, but it seemed to us in not a well thought through kind of a way, because there was this whole management and maintenance vacuum that my colleagues have spoken about. But there was another dimension as well, and that was to do with the difficulty that very poor people have in living in these units in terms of any kind of home-based enterprise, local level income generation, anything like that. We are seeing that kind of activity throughout our housing settlements, but throughout old townships, former townships, old white suburbs, we are seeing home-based economic activity, people doing spas or shops and a million other kinds of economic activity, including backyard rental. And that we know after years and years of watching this, seeing this, learning about it, that this is a critical form of income generation. We're in a context of unbelievably high unemployment, almost by definition, the kind of people that are benefiting from a government subsidized, fully subsidized house or unit are unemployed, almost by definition. They're living on grants or whatever. And yet these multi-story walk-ups do not provide for home-based income generation at all. And in fact, what they seem to be doing is deliberately shutting off the potential for backyarding because that is seen as sullying the neighborhood or re-informalizing or any of these kinds of things that are seen to be very problematic, particularly when these are in close proximity to bonded units in the mixed income developments. But it seemed to us that this is a very short-sighted way of looking at things because it's really not understanding the link between people's place of residence and the way in which they are earning an income, and how these two things have to be thought of absolutely in conjunction in our current context. And we've got to get much smarter and much cleverer about how to facilitate those kind of relationships, not how to curtail them and to stop them. I can move on to the messy cities part of it, maybe just to make a quick link. What we are saying with this term messy cities or messy governance, we're referring to governance in the sense of multiple actors shaping and influencing and forging our cities, and multiple actors that are not necessarily controlled or directed or orchestrated by government itself. So in many parts of the world, one uses that notion of governance, having in mind a strong role for the state to be shaping and directing the private sector and other actors. But in many of the cities that we are looking at across the African continent, there are these multiple actors, but forces may be unpredictable, unauthorized, outside of intended outcomes. Some people use terms like rogue urbanism or other kinds of terms. It's messy in the sense of not following the processes and the systems prescribed by government or intended by planners, but all sorts of things happening in parallel. And we are seeing that in our own neighborhoods because of the kind of socioeconomic context that we find ourselves in and the fact that our planned environments are not predicting and anticipating that exactly these kinds of things are going to arise. And so bringing it back to the walk-ups, we feel it was incredibly short-sighted to be rolling out thousands of these units that attempt to sort of forestall or curtail that kind of activity, which is actually essential to the way people need to survive in urban areas these days. Peach, that's a long mouthful. I'm going to stop there.
Sarah, I appreciate sort of covering those bases of not only the dimensions of this Vleerhof multi-story walk-up RDP type of development, but also this idea of the concept of messiness and how that permeates through the book and the chapters. Neil, you've made a point around the idea of it being a public-private partnership, a PPP, on the one hand facilitated by the state, but built by the private sector. Any lessons learned here in terms of where risks lie, in terms of due diligence, in terms of new projects, similar density typology, what they would need to do differently from this particular case study that you've looked at?
Well, if you're going to follow a public-private partnership, it's normally that the state has the oversight over the private sector build. That is absolutely essential. If you don't have that oversight, you're bound to suffer future consequences. And I think this is what we've seen in this particular model and the numbers that have been rolled out, and we've simply not seen adequate oversight. So the state has to be sure that it has the capacity to undertake that oversight. We are thinking in our case study, one thought that the private sector were going to deal with that aspect. The private sector also thought that. So it basically is something that just fell between tables, but it was so fundamental to the ongoing sustainability of this model. So certainly going forward, I think if you're going to follow the PPP model, you've got to make sure that all of the various components are in place and not just roll out a model without ensuring that oversight is in place.
It's interesting when one looks at the book chapter and I'm not sure if it's a drone that's captured the photograph, but it certainly shows you the typologies that we're talking about, demonstrating, I think it looks like a four, possibly five-story walk-up environment, a series of them structured along the main arterial as you turn off the main road. And behind that, the scaling down into more what we'd call RDP type or affordable housing, single story structures. So it's really well illustrated. And I get the point that's been made that this was obviously a real project pilot to try and break the monotony and this idea that you can't do differentiated typologies. But if you haven't resolved those issues of the management of maintenance and that old sticking point around a body corporate or similar, then clearly those maintenance issues are going to become quickly a deterioration aspect if it's not dealt with. Are these some of the take-home points that you think absolutely have to be looked at in future medium to high-density walk-up type environments?
Talking Problems is looking at that. They are proposing a five-year process where the private sector would provide resources to try and take that type of management. But again, it's in the implementation, whether this is something that's properly thought through, given the number of units that have already been produced. Absolutely essential.
We could go into a whole episode just on this point alone. So thank you to the three of you for your reflections on that. I've walked the journey of inclusionary housing, both in a Joburg and to a lesser extent in the City of Cape Town space. I was really interested in what Jonty Cogger and Robin Park Ross from Endofuna Kwazi had to say on the matter, specifically around the inclusionary housing aspects here in Cape Town. What were some of the key take-home points that you think were worth reflecting on in relation to that chapter? And the reason I raise it is because the inclusionary housing aspect is one of the things that we've often come back to on the podcast, and hoping that there's some new content that can help shape the thinking either of do more of this or conversely do more or less of what Jonty and Robin are reflecting on in their chapter.
I think Jonty and Robin's chapter is really, really interesting because in some ways, I find it a very positive reflection I find it a very encouraging reflection because in some ways it talks to the fact that some of the constitution and some of the kind of legal and judicial processes in South Africa are working. The constitution and many, many pieces of policy say there are spaces for negotiation, there's processes, procedures, and protocols which you can use to give everyone a fair shout. They talk about the fact that the space has been cleaved open. I think this is exactly the point, is that the constitution and various other pieces say, here is the starting point, but it is going to take champions. It is going to take work. It is going to take effort and advocacy for people to take these little crevices and cleave them open into spaces which are fully functioning democratic spaces of engagement, but it is possible. And I think what we've seen now is that the fact that inclusionary housing is now very much on the agenda in Cape Town. Most recently, I've seen that there's now been some very well-located social housing which has been put in place. And so this whole thing seems to work. And it's interesting to me because it feels like to be really dramatic and really dedicated and quite radical in your approach, though, to make these spaces work. And that's really interesting to me as well in terms of what they're pointing to. And it seems to show that urban governance is this really difficult, contested space that requires a lot of champions, a lot of people to push and to shove and to fight and to fight back. But in some ways, I kind of feel like, well, that's great. That's democracy at work. That's what we need, is this kind of argy-bargy around real argument and real interaction and people forcing their views. And thank goodness that there are organizations like NU around to be able to do that. And I know they're not always popular. No, not everyone agrees with their particular methods. But I, for one, kind of salute them and appreciate their advocacy.
What I found really interesting about that particular chapter was Ndifuno Kwazi's discussion about how they used the municipal planning tribunal space to be an advocate for this, a body established in terms of SPLUMA. And, you know, I'm not a planner, so I'm not all okay with all of these things. But what they describe in the chapter is a very conscious and deliberate strategy of using the tribunal space. So knowing that when development proposals are coming through, where there are objections being heard, that they, as an advocacy organization, can take that space to argue particular points, to make the point about the need for inclusionary housing to be incorporated in new residential developments, in a way to speak for those who should be having a voice at these kind of forums, but who actually aren't there. They aren't there because they don't know about the particular development coming ahead. They don't live in the neighborhood. They live elsewhere. In the case of Cape Town, maybe they live on the Cape Flats or somewhere else. This particular organization is saying, okay, there is a forum where we can make our voice heard and we're going to use that gap. But they also talk about how these kinds of forums are full of experts. They're full of town planning experts, legal planning practitioners, people who understand the system, the terminology, the processes very well. And that in order to be a combatant in the space, you yourself have to equip yourself with that kind of terminology, the understanding of the processes in order to take the gap when the gap comes up. I found that their kind of very skillful use of that particular process, an absolutely fascinating description in the book chapter. I'm going to prescribe it for my students next year.
Well, certainly in terms of advocacy around this issue in Cape Town, there's certainly no better respondents, to use that legal term, than NU, and particularly from Robin and Jonty. Neil, anything from your side on that? Yeah, please come in, my friend.
Yes, I mean, this might be more of a personal view of mine. I think the chapter and what they're doing is so critically important as well in terms of entrenching a principle. And given our colonial apartheid history and that legacy that has created such massive inequalities, the principle of redistribution, and that in every sector, there needs to be some level of redistribution. And in this case, it's in the property development sector. And as an article written by Margot, Alice and myself, inclusionary housing isn't going to solve the low-cost housing issue at all, given the numbers. But I think what's so critically important is entrenching a principle that you have to actually contribute into trying to resolve these inequalities. And this is a contribution from the property sector. And yes, it does reduce profit margins and so on. But that is the nature of the context that we are living in and working in. So I think entrenching that principle in people's minds is so critically important.
Now, it also brings into sharp focus this idea of power dynamics in relation to either political doctrine, in relation to the, I think they use the term NIMBYism, they're not in my backyard, how that can play itself out in often very opaque ways, but actually driving a particular agenda, which is retain the status quo as opposed to challenge that. And I think a lot of that legislative environment post-Spluma has tried to get us to challenge convention, challenge approaches. And yeah, I think there's a lot to take from that. The conclusions that they come to certainly suggest that there's lots more to be done in that, in this particular space. It is interesting to me that in terms of the contributions you've got, and unless I've missed it, you didn't get the voice of, for example, a government official or politician looking back on the framing of their experience in that. Is that something that was an unfortunate outcome of the responses that you had, or deliberate? Was there anything that you weren't able to include? How did that sort of shape up in a book such as this, where you're dealing with governance but don't have that official point of view? Is that one of the things that you look back on with a sense of regret? Or, as I say, have I missed something in the actual approach that you took there?
We do have officials from Mangaung. There are some officials in that. It's co-written with an academic, so it's a mixed piece. And look, I can only speak for myself on this one, but I don't think the intention of the book was ever to be a resource necessarily for best practice for practitioners, for whatever. It was very much an academic reflection. And to my mind, it was intended to be an academic reflection. I think there definitely is space, and maybe our next project could be a broader kind of handbook, which could include the voices of experience of people who are practitioners and are in practice, both in government and the private sector. And that might be absolutely fascinating. But for me, it wasn't intended in this particular publication. So can't do everything.
I can add what the book illuminated for me is just how much more there is to discuss and debate and learn about the issue of governance through the housing lens, because we only got a taste of different contexts and different kinds of practices, whether they were state-driven practices or resident-driven or private sector-driven. There's so much that isn't in the book that could be. And so it kind of feels like we should be exploring other contexts and countries, and definitely practitioners' experiences would be incredibly rich to bring in there. I think it's partly the nature of also doing a kind of a scholarly publication. It's quite frankly not everyone's cup of tea. It's not what everyone thinks is the most useful way to express their views in a book chapter or an article that has to go through peer review and go through the academic hoops that we are required to do because of our positions at universities. For a lot of people, it feels like a tediously lengthy sort of process, and the academic conventions feel a bit stifling, whereas people would rather write a shorter kind of report or speak into a workshop type situation. And maybe the trick for us is to try and find a kind of a platform or an event where bringing together those kinds of voices and reflecting against what we think we've been able to bring out in the book might be quite productive for everybody concerned. You know, maybe doing something like the SAPI conference could be useful, seeing how this kind of reflection and this particular way of writing and producing work can be useful as a sounding board for practitioners and vice versa. So maybe there's lots in that kind of general arena and interface for us to explore in the future.
So that makes a lot of sense. I think, again, I can only sort of speak from my own experience. Sometimes it can also be quite difficult to get permission to contribute to these things on behalf of the organization or municipality or whatever it may be, whether it's through that idea of some sort of symposium or possibly a future publication that addresses some of this. I think it would make for a very interesting contrast between this sort of idea of the practitioner in the municipal space and the academic view that you've obviously cultivated through the book. A couple of us were involved in a public engagement last week with the stakeholders from government and beyond, looking at a draft white paper for human settlements, setting the scene for 2024, potentially some sort of legal reform and thinking in the human settlement and housing space. Are there elements that either really help shape the problem statement? And I think, as you say, from the very get-go of this episode, we're saying that the three of you have been very much involved in housing for the entire era of democracy in South Africa post-94. Where are we in, I'm calling it 2024 because it's a week or two away, where are we and how can the book start to point us in the right direction of do more of this and do less of that, because the lessons there are evident in these different cities and different countries that you've looked at?
I think certainly in the South African context, it is indicating that just due to sheer lack of resources, both human capacity, physical resources, the state cannot be seen to be the only producer of low-cost housing, and that their role is going to be have to become more facilitatory, particularly in terms of self-help and incremental housing to poor communities and informal settlements rather than relying on the private sector as well. And how can they facilitate that proper in-situ upgrading of informal settlements and to focus on those types of skill sets that are required to do that? I think the shift needs to accommodate going forward and not to be perceived as the only provider that only they can provide. Because in actual fact, we've seen cases where they're actually obstructing provision through their lack of capacity. We really don't need that.
One of the points Sarah made earlier is the fact that, in our view, urban governance is about the fact that you've got a whole lot of different parties, urban actors and agents coming together. It's through their kind of contestation and conflict, but also through their collaboration and coalitions that the city is built, that the city evolves, that the city changes over time. These can be built upon really, really usefully. And I think that's exactly what Neil was alluding to. If we were to harness all these different actors and instead of seeing them as opposition, and this includes resident built, this includes private sector in various forms of whatever that might look like, then we have a real possibility of trying to create inclusive spaces that are integrated and that work for a number of citizens and residents. But if we persist in continuing doing the same thing the same way over and over again, we're going to get the same result. And that's kind of the definition of insanity.
The nature of our state institutions are fundamentally different to the way they were even 15 years ago, 20 years ago. Certainly in many parts of the country, we have weak forms of government, weak institutions. That's not to say that they aren't absolutely fantastic and completely wonderful individuals within local government and provincial government and national government. But many of the strong systems that we thought we had, the ability to be able to rely on processes of implementation, of management, of forward planning, those are simply not there in some of our local government systems and provincial government systems. And it's unclear how soon we will be able to build those back up or strengthen them sufficiently to really be able to have the kind of ambitions that the state in South Africa has had in previous years. And so I think we do need to confront that situation, and we need to think hard about what does it mean to be trying to operate in that kind of context. It's an incredibly hard one with incredibly complex politics playing itself out. And that really doesn't bode well for having a clear vision that the state itself is going to roll out anything or even that easily facilitate things. So I think there's a lot of thinking to be done about the kind of institutional context. And then my other big concern that I think needs to be coming into our deliberations around housing is this issue about the economic context that we find ourselves in. So I was talking about this earlier, and the bigger issue of the massive unemployment and the fact that we have entrenched joblessness. We don't really see how the job situation is going to change very easily in the future. You know, we've got intergenerational joblessness. And so we have to think differently about how people are surviving, how they're earning an income, and what the kind of spatial relationship is to home, and whether it's a kind of a hustle on the side or a main home-based business. But that kind of economic relationship between home space and income space, we've got to confront head on. And it's showing itself in multiple ways in our cities, in the way in which people are spending a lot of money for a very small bit of space in the inner city and somewhere like Joburg, or how people are paying a lot of money for a small rental room in well-located areas like Alex. I'm using Joburg examples, of course, because that's where I'm based. It's coming through in multiple ways, and we've really got to confront that. And I'm not sure that the sort of socioeconomic reality in which we're trying to think about housing, I don't think that's coming through in the kinds of policy documents that are coming through in the housing space. And I think it has to be absolutely front and central.
Well, there's certainly a lot to think about. The book itself is well worth a read. Where can people find out more about the book? Where is it available? Are there PDFs available to purchase, the sort of e-book reader? How do people go about getting a hold of a copy?
If you just do a search for Housing in African Cities, A Lens on Governance, you'll be able to pick it up, but it is on the Springer website.
Unfortunately, the price is not easy for many people. However, libraries seem to have taken up the ebook quite rapidly. So anyone who's got an institutional link to somewhere like WITS or UCT or one of the libraries will be able to get the ebook.
As we work towards 2024, colleagues, I'm sure you're all going to have busy festive periods and hopefully a chance to breathe. I think, Neil, as you're saying, you've already started to decompress there in Betty's Bay. But what does 2024 hold for each of you? If we start Margo across the waters there in the UK, in Cardiff, what does 2024 hopefully hold for you?
So we recently received news, we as in Sarah and I, that the Volvo Research and Education Foundation, we were successful in getting a grant application for, thank you very much, for doing a project looking at questions of gender identity, intersectionality, and walking in Dar es Salaam, Cardiff, and Trani. So to make an interesting combination of cities. So yeah, three different cities. So we're going to be working with some colleagues, particularly Priscilla Izar and Albert Nyeti in Dar. Well, Priscilla's here, but Albert's in Dar. That's definitely on the cards. And then hopefully promoting the book a bit, hopefully a book launch or two. We're not sure how that's going to happen or when it's going to happen. And then for me personally, hopefully a project on looking at residence associations and elite governance in African cities. So I'm hoping that that's going to come to the fore. And then I think the three of us have got another article that we're due to write, also on walk-ups, that's going to come out in a special issue in the next while. One or two things to keep us busy, aside from teaching, supervising, living, the usual kinds of stuff.
Being a mother, watching football.
Oh, yeah.
Getting it,
yeah.
Would be there.
No, leave that all to my son. But, you know, all the other stuff.
Sounds like you've got a busy year ahead of you, Margo. Thanks for sharing and thanks for your inputs today.
And thanks for having us, Pete. Really appreciate it.
A pleasure. Neil, from your side?
From my side, well, I've just recently completed my PhD, so I'll be consolidating some of those articles in the coming year. We're also running a city studio again at Wits University, and I'm hoping to do a little bit of research into community land trusts in that particular project. And as Margo says, we still have some outstanding work to be done on the walk-ups. Hopefully taking it a little bit easier next year, but who knows?
I somehow doubt it, Neil, but enjoy, and as I have a good time down there in Betty's. Sarah, your side?
So Neil mentioned the city studio. People might remember that a few years ago, our school at Wits was very involved in Yeovil in sort of a neighborhood-based investigation with our students, with community partners in Yeovil. So our forthcoming one that Neil mentioned is centered around the Frankenwald, Alex kind of area of Joburg. Very interesting and complex area. So we'll see how that unfolds over the next couple of years. I'm involved with a colleague in the UK, Professor Paula Meth, with some work on housing and youth and work and kind of the intersection between young people's lives, trying to house themselves as in gain independent housing, but how this relates to the difficulties of getting work. And we've been looking at some case studies here in Gauteng, but also in the town of Hawassa in Ethiopia. So we're hoping to develop that work a little bit more. Something else that a number of colleagues are involved with is trying to understand the kind of investment that's going into former homeland areas in South Africa, where there's an extraordinary amount of individual money going into houses being built, quite smart houses, but also shopping centers, building supply areas, all sorts of things in some of the parts of the country that we thought might, I suppose, depopulate after apartheid, but actually that hasn't happened. And we're trying to understand the links to urban areas, the economies of these areas. And so I'm sort of only very peripherally involved at the moment, but I think that's a really interesting area of work that I'm hoping to learn much more about going forward. But first, a rest at the end of the year.
A well-deserved rest, Sarah. A well-deserved rest for all three of you. I can't thank you enough for spending a bit of time here on our South African Monday afternoon or there in Cardiff, just the earlier part of the afternoon. Thank you so much to the three of you for spending time with me and just sharing some of the ideas and your reflections on the book. Congratulations on getting it published. I know it's always a big, big effort to get these things across the line. I know it's not your first rodeo, but certainly never gets easier in terms of collaborators, drafts, et cetera, et cetera.
I'd like to say a really big thank you to all the contributors and all the authors who contributed to the book. We know it took a long, long time, and we appreciate each and every one of you staying with us and staying with the process. Well, it was a mammoth task, and we couldn't have done it without you, and we couldn't have done it without the fabulous reviewers and without the administrators and everybody else who contributed to the book. And thank you to the publishers and to the series publishers, to Gustav and to Chris and to everybody else, and most importantly to Sarah and Neil. So thank you to you guys.
Margo, yeah, all of the chapter authors would want to express thanks to the people involved in the housing stories that they write about. You know, we've all drawn on the insights and experience of people living quite difficult lives often in some of these settlements, trying to forge new kinds of housing futures. So thanks to all of them too. Thank you, Pete, for your wonderful podcast series. It's really great.
No, thank you, colleagues. It's only there because it has good contributors. And thank you for being part of it and contributing in this way today. Congrats. All the best for you in the new year. And hopefully get a chance to catch up with you as the research develops. Have a lovely festive. Look after yourselves.
Thanks for having us.
We hope you enjoyed this content of the Talking Transformation podcast. Please feel free to give us feedback via our Twitter platform. That's at Talking Transfo and the number one. Or alternatively, via our email address, talkingtransformation101@gmail.com. Thanks and recognition also to Tribal Need for allowing us to use their track, Flags, as our introductory and closeout music on this podcast.